The word backsliding is not found after the day of Pentecost. And yet it's a word that so many Christians use of their brothers and sisters who've lost the way and gone off the road. They'll say, "Oh, isn't it sad about so-and-so? He has become a backslider." But in fact, that word is not found in the New Testament. You never find it after the day of Pentecost. You see, the assumption is in the New Testament that to be a Christian is to go on. To be a Christian is to make progress. To be a Christian is to grow up. It's the only sure mark that you are a Christian, that you are making some kind of spiritual progress. Not that you're talking the right language, because anybody can do that. Not that you sit and listen to the right preachers, anybody can do that. Not that you come to church a lot, anybody can do that. The only test that you are a living Christian is that you are making some kind of significant spiritual progress. You see, the day of Pentecost secures this. Backsliding is an Old Testament word. It's a pre-Pentecostal word. And it's even more curious. The Bible's full of curious things. The longer you live, the curiouser they get. Even in the Old Testament, you don't read about men and women becoming backsliders. You read about a nation becoming backslidden, or a church becoming backslidden, but not individual men and women. Now, isn't that strange? Because it's a word that we use so commonly of Christians who are not making the grade, or Christians who have gone back from their original stand, and their original position, and the original flag they were waving, and they go back from this, and we say, "Oh, hi, they become backsliders." But in fact, that's not how it's used in the Bible. And so I'm a little slow and hesitant to speak about the backsliding of Saul. And yet we must use that word, because it's the only word really that fits the description of the man. When you think of all that God gave him in his three initial spiritual experiences, Rachel's tomb, where he learned that all power costs death. If you want power in your life, then you've got to die. Something in you has to die if you want to be spiritually effective for Christ. Rachel's tomb. The message of Bethel. You remember how he was sent to these places by Samuel to drink in the message. The message of Bethel, which is the message of prevenient grace. Grace coming before everything. Grace before you trusted God. Grace before you were born. Grace before the universe was made. Grace before absolutely everything. Prevenient grace. That's the message of Bethel, Jacob, and the ladder, and the angels coming down, and nobody asking Jacob to come up. It's not a religion of self-effort. God comes down the ladder, and that's grace. Then thirdly, there was the message of Gilgal, the third place to which Samuel sent him, and which means a rolling away, the message there being that whoever wants to serve Christ needs to have gone through a deep, deep, deep cleansing. life has to be washed completely. His sin must be rolled away. Gilgal, Galgal. It's the Hebrew word, Galgal. A rolling away. A complete and a profound cleansing of life before we serve. And these are Saul's three primary spiritual experiences. But now, you see, he has become a backslider. Now, I want to think this evening, although perhaps you may find this a little solemn at the start of a year, we'll finish on a brighter note, but there are some serious things to think of. First of all, something that a lot of people don't understand and have spoken to me about, which is the departure of the Spirit from Saul, the coming of the Spirit to David, and an evil spirit sent from God. Now that's how the Bible puts it. An evil spirit from the Lord troubles Saul. Now, can you see the movement? Watch the movement. In the beginning, the Spirit of God came upon Saul so violently that he prophesied. And it went round the whole countryside. Mercy, this farmer's gone all religious, because he took no interest in religion before that. He was more interested in beef stock prices, you know, fat stock prices at the market. He was a man of the earth. He was interested in beasts and manure. And suddenly he was preaching, and people said, mercy, here's a farmer who's gone all religious. And the Spirit of God possessed him. Then he drifts, 30 years drifts. The Spirit leaves him and comes upon David, so that David now becomes the real king. Although Saul is on the throne, the center of gravity has shifted. The real initiative has shifted. This is what happens, you see, in Christian life. That people who do not move with God get stuck. They draw the line with Christ and they get stuck. But God's never stuck. He goes marching on. And the only happy people in this world, and the only satisfied people in the Christian church, are the Christians who are marching on with God. If you are stuck with Jesus Christ tonight, you are of all men the most miserable. You're like the Hebrews in the Old Testament. They could neither go back to Egypt, nor could they see the promised land. They were stuck in a wilderness. They couldn't go back because they'd been redeemed from that. But they couldn't go forward because of their unbelief. Saul pottered about with God for 30 years. You're still the king, but the real spiritual initiative has moved to somebody else. I've been a Christian 20 years, and I have seen this happening countless times. Christians who are shunted into the sidings, Christians who are left behind, and the work of God goes marching on. That's Saul. Spirit comes on David, and an evil spirit from the Lord comes upon Saul. Now that's very, very strange, and some people have found it disturbing. Look at one or two scriptures. First of all, in 1 Samuel 18, which we read, and look at verse 10. In fact, the language is stronger here, you see. It says, on the morrow an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house. What's this? Is it badness? Or madness? Or demon possession? What's wrong with this man? Something very far wrong. On the morrow an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul cast the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice. The same strange sort of thing in the next chapter, chapter 19. If you care to turn it over, there are one or two references tonight. David's on the run now, you see, in the next chapter. And Saul is trying to send out his servants to capture him. Look at verse 19. And it was told Saul, behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, Ramah was Samuel's home, you see. That's where the old man lived. And Samuel, standing as head over them, these are Pentecostals. These are the ecstatic, charismatic prophets of the early days. Although I think Samuel should have, forgive me, I think he should have tamed them. It can get out of hand, you see. That sort of religion can sometimes become over emotional. I'm not saying it doesn't have a foundation in God's word, but sometimes it gets out of control. I know a lot of Christians who have gone out of control because they've got involved with this sort of thing, you see. The Bible says, you young Christians who are interested in Pentecostal gifts and charismatic gifts in the church, the Bible says, the spirit of the prophets is subject to the prophets. Control, you see? Self-control. Very important. Where are we? 20. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied, and so they failed in their mission. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. You see, they couldn't get away from all the emotion and power of the place, and they got wrapped up with it. Then he himself went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in Seku, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah. And he went from there to Naioth in Ramah. And the Spirit of God came upon him also. This is a difficult passage, and I don't know quite what to make of it. But I do know this. Saul was a man who was so emotionally unstable that he was caught up by any spiritual movement. I think of, I'm a Murray Coast loon. I think of how some of the old revivals along the Murray Coast, starting around the 1880s, further back than Jock Troop. Some of you remember Jock Troop, but there were reawakenings along the Murray Coast, further back than that, 1880s. And I think of how shallow some of these movements were. People were caught up by the emotionalism of it, the music and the appeals. If ever you go to Port Nocky along the coast there, go to the caves at the front on the cliffs where these revivals took place, and you can see all the texts painted by the fisher folk. God is love, you must be born again, except a man be converted he cannot see the kingdom. All of this round the caves. And some of these revivals were so ecstatic that they were called the dancing revivals, because people used to dance. But they didn't last long. Superficial, you see. People can get caught up by this kind of thing. And there was a superficiality in the character of Saul. He was impressed by anything that was passing by and caught up by it. And here he goes again, you see. 24, look at this. He too stripped off his clothes. He's preaching naked now. And he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Hence it is said, is Saul also among the prophets, this great big farmer? What a strange man. But how can an evil spirit come from God? Well, it's a great problem, but here's the answer to it. 1 Kings 22. This is a great, great chapter. It's about the end of Ahab, Jezebel's husband. I'll explain as I go along. 1 Kings 22. I'm trying to show you how an evil spirit can come from God. For 3 years, Syria, in the far north, that's where Damascus is today, and Israel, which is the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes that broke away after the death of Solomon, Syria and Israel continued without war. But in the 3rd year, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, that's in the south, came down, we would say came up, you see, because it's Israel is above Judah on the map, but they say came down. Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel in the north said to his servants, do you know that Ramoth Gilead, on the other side of the river Jordan, belongs to us? And we keep quiet, and do not take it out of the hand of the king of Syria. He's spoiling for war. And he said to Jehoshaphat, king of the south, will you go with me to battle at Ramoth Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as you are. My people are as your people. My horses are as your horses. We're behind you. Come on, we'll go to war. And Jehoshaphat of Judah said to the king of Israel, inquire first for the word of the Lord. You see, Judah was a godly kingdom. They were interested in whether God had anything to say on the matter. They don't make politicians like this anymore. When did you hear any of them speaking about God? It's not that they couldn't. They're members of churches. Mr. Wilson is a member of the United Reformed Church, the Union of the Presbyterian Church of England and the Congregationalists down in England. Mr. Heath is Church of England. Church of England. They never mention God. Do you know why? It's not politic. It would be unwise. It would cloud the issues if they brought God into them. Isn't this sad? But Jehoshaphat, you see, knows a thing or two. Verse 5, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Inquire first for the word of the Lord." Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go to battle against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I forbear?" And they said, "Go up, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king." But Jehoshaphat said, he wasn't sure, you see. There had been so many false preachers up there, he wasn't sure, and he wanted to try again. "Is there not here another prophet of the Lord of whom we may inquire? Are these all your ministers?" They seem like a collection of yes men to me. They're all nodding their heads in the court. "Is there nobody else?" And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Well, if you insist, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, Micaiah, the son of Imlah. But I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but evil. This is Jezebel's husband." You see, he wanted a minister who would flatter him. He was not interested in truth. He was more interested in the plaudits and applause and approval of men than he was in the truth of God. It was just a job. He wanted ministers who were only interested in jobs. That's all. The Bible's very contemporary. Verse 8. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "There is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but evil." And Jehoshaphat said, "Let not the king say so." You see, he was godly. Then the king of Israel summoned an officer and said, "Bring quickly Micaiah, the son of Imlah." Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting on their thrones, arrayed in their robes, at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria. And all the prophets were prophesying before them. These are the yes men, you see. And Zedekiah, one of the prophets, the son of Kenana, made for himself horns of iron and said, "Thus says the Lord, with these you shall push the Syrians until they are destroyed." And all the prophets prophesied so and said, "Go up to Ramoth Gilead and triumph. The Lord will give it into the hand of the king." It was all lies, you see. This is where Ahab died. And the messenger who went to summon Micaiah said to him, "Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably." Change your message. About 80 years before I went to Holy Town, my previous church, there was a vacancy. And a young chap who was an able preacher of the gospel was asked to preach for the pulpit. And before he went in, one of the elders said, "If you change your message, will attack ye. And he went in, and before he started to preach, he said, I think I ought to tell you that I am not now preaching for this church. I am preaching the gospel. And he lost it. Change your message, Micaiah. The Bible is so contemporary. I don't know why people don't read it. 13. And the messenger who went to summon Micaiah said to him, Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably. But Micaiah said, As the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, that I will speak. When he had come to the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered him very sarcastically, Go up and triumph. Isn't that what your yes men have been saying? The Lord will give it into the hand of the king. But the king said to him, How many times shall I adjure you that you speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? What lies! That's the one thing he didn't want to hear. How many times shall I adjure you that you speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? And he said, Micaiah said, and here's the truth. I saw all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master, no master, no king. Finished. Let each man return to his home in peace. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, Did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? Don't you see what's happening? It wouldn't have mattered what Micaiah said. The king wouldn't believe it. He preached sarcastically, and the king said, Come on now, none of that. Tell me the truth. So he preached the truth and said, You will die, and all your army will be wiped out, like sheep without a shepherd. And the king said, How dare you come here and start all that nonsense again? There are some people, you know, and it wouldn't matter what you preach to them. They wouldn't be pleased. 19. And Micaiah said, Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who will entice Ahab, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead? And one said one thing, and another said another. Then our spirit came forward. Watch this, friends. A spirit came forward and stood before the Lord. I hope you know who he is, saying, I will entice Ahab. And the Lord said to him, By what means? And he said, Hope you recognize the spirit, you see. The deceiving spirit. I will go forth and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, you are to entice him, you see, an evil spirit from the Lord. Go forth and do so. You shall succeed. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets. The Lord has spoken evil concerning you. Does that make it simpler to understand? That Saul loses the blessing comes on David, and a false spirit comes on Saul. 24, I wish there were time. Then Zedekiah the son of Kenana came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, how did the Spirit of the Lord go from me to speak to you? Micaiah said, behold, you shall see on that day when you shall go to an inner chamber to hide yourself from the invading armies. And the king of Israel said, seize Micaiah and take him back to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, thus says the king, put this fellow in prison, and feed him with scant fare of bread and water, until I come in peace, which would be never, for he was killed. Micaiah said, if you return in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me. And he said, hear all you peoples. He's dragged out, you see, at that point, saying, hear all you peoples. But it's a great story. Reading on, 33, for speed's sake, when the captains of the chariots went into the battle now, saw that it was not the king of Israel, they changed clothes. You see, Ahab went in disguise. He wouldn't wear armor. He wore ordinary clothes. They turned back from pursuing him. 34. But a certain man drew his bow at a venture by chance and struck the king of Israel, Ahab, Jezebel's husband, between the scale armor and the breastplate underneath his clothes. Therefore he said to the driver of his chariot, turn about and carry me out of the battle, for I am wounded. And the battle grew hot that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Syrians. Did he think about Micaiah's sermon, I wonder, as he was dying? Was he all day like that in the chariot, thinking about what the true man of God had said? Propped up in his chariot facing the Syrians, until at evening he died, and the blood of the wound flowed into the bottom of the chariot. And about sunset a cry went through the army, every man to his city and every man to his country. So King Ahab died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria, and they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, and the harlots washed themselves in it. Oh! Oh! What an end! Because he wouldn't listen to the preacher. What a story. What a story. Now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did, the ivory house which he built, of course, they liked their luxury, these chaps. And all the cities that he built, go to Palestine sometime, go to Samaria, go and see Jezebel's palace with walls 8, 9 feet, 12 feet thick. She thought she was here forever. She thought she was everlasting, Jezebel. All the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah his son, reign in his stead. Does that help? Blessing comes on Saul because he gets stuck. Moves to David. He's the real king. He's the anointed. And this evil spirit begins to trouble Saul so that he becomes a castaway and a reject. Does that help? I hope so. Lastly, the question of Michal. 1 Samuel 18. Why did Saul give Michal to David? Verse 20. Chapter 18 and verse 20. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. She's a lady, by the way. She's as cold a piece as ever you would want to look upon. You know what was wrong with her. It's an interesting history. She never really loved God. Never really. She was like these barnacles, you know, that they get on the ship's bottoms that have to be scraped off. She was a sycophant. She lived off the religion of others. She was like a leech, to change the metaphor. She just sucked the blood from the religion of others, but she had no religion in herself. You can see this much later on, when she despises David for enjoying God. She just despised him because her heart was cold, cold, cold. And Saul saw that this lady loved David, and she said, "Now, I've got him now." And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hands of the Philistines may be against him." Why would the hands of the Philistines be against David if he married this girl? Well, I'll tell you. There are two reasons. If you turn to chapter 9 and verse 11, you see, friends, before you marry a girl, ask her if she keeps idols in the house. Because all the time that David was worshipping Jehovah, Michal was saying her prayers to gods of wood and stone. Because when David was on the run from Saul, she sort of tried to protect David. And whereas nowadays we would take a bolster and stuff it full of feathers and stick it up in the bed, she didn't need to do that. She had ready-made idols, and she stuck one of her gods in the bed to deceive her father's soldiers. You see, so all the time David was saying his prayers to the real God, his wife had other ideas. Young chaps, before you marry a girl, ask her if she keeps idols in the house. And if she does, don't marry her. Be not unequally yoked. You know? Chapter 19 and verse 11. That night Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image. Where did that come from? It's one of our gods. And laid it on the bed, and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head, and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He's sick." Who's sick? Michal or David? And that's why Saul wanted David to marry this girl, because he knew that she could corrupt him, you see, and seduce him from Jehovah. Secondly, sorry about these references, but I want to bring out the flavor of the truth. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, you see what a cold little heart she had, maybe made of tin or lead or something, granite maybe, marble, cold. 2 Samuel 6 and verse 16. As the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, enjoying his religion, this cold little piece, viewed all this with great disdain. Funny how people keep their enthusiasm for everything but their religion. What enthusiasm for culture and sport and friendships and parties and social entertainment and music and games. What enthusiasm. But very, very, very cold when it comes to religion. That's Michal with her little tin heart looking out of the window. What a sad little piece she was. She saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And they brought in the ark of the Lord, and so on. Verse 20. And David returned to bless his household, but Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David, and her mouth was full of vinegar. She said, "How the king of Israel honored himself today." You see, he'd been dancing in the air. People could see his legs jumping about. "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants' maids, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord." Whatever you reserve your enthusiasms for, "I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes, but by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. We often say, don't we, that God is no man's debtor. And to compensate for this cold fish of a woman, God gave David a man. You know what David said just after Jonathan died? That the love of Jonathan meant more to him than the love of women. A great thing. Wonder if this will help somebody here Because there are Christians here, I know, who are very insular. Your lives are islands. And you are go it alone, people. You're very independent. You like to keep your life to yourself. I tell you, and I'm speaking to one or two particularly, I think you could do a great work for Christ if God gave you a friend. F-R-I-E-N-D. Special kind of love. It's usually man and man, or woman and woman. But I have known friendship between a man and a woman, although it's rather risky because they tend to fall in love and then it stops being friendship love and it starts being another kind of love, because there are different kinds of love. But I have known a man to have friendship love with a woman, although that's very, very rare. It's usually man and man or woman and woman. You see, David had a son called Solomon, and Solomon said, two are better than one. So you insular Christians, maybe the time has come for you to ask God to give you a friend like Jonathan. Thy love for me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. Oh, it's a great thing. Now, I've lived long enough to see wonderful things for Christ being done by friends. Two are better than one. Does that mean something to somebody? I think, judging by the smiles in your faces, it does. Some of you are far too insular. You're far too spiky, and you're far too fond of keeping your lives to yourselves. Ask God to give you a Jonathan.